called Southern Africa because it's not just South Africa, it's also Namibia. And if any of you have been around this week at all, you know that already, but in case anyone came in or has been out hiking, I wanted to make that clear. There are four people on our panel tonight, and starting at this end is Chuck Lutz, officially titled Executive Director for the Office of Church and Society of the ALC.
Wow.
But he's knows a lot about Namibia, and although he hasn't been there, he told me, I asked him when we last there, because he said, I've been there, and I've been listening to this week, and he knows a whole lot about the area. And Jim Carr, next, is the National Director of Lutheran Campus Ministry. That's his official title. And he is on this mainly because he has dealt a lot with the idea of protest and how one can express their opinions when in fact they are not the ones in power. And
I also qualify as being one who's not been.
He also qualifies, he's not there either. Okay. And then Barbara Rossi, and she is on the interpretation staff of the ALC World Mission. And she has been there. I think it's three times?
No, twice.
Has led two study seminars in South Africa in this last year, and then it's going to go again. And on the end is Dan Erlander of international repute. And on the end
is that next to the international repute.
We just put him up here because he knows so much about everything. No. But no, actually, he and Karin just got back from Namibia and South Africa and have some opinions also. We're going to start with two, approximately 5-minute sessions of Barbara and Chuck. And then basically it's going to be opened up for all of you to question or challenge or dialogue with these people. Okay, Chuck? Oh, Barbara.
And the focus is on what we can do.
Right, okay.
That's narrow up to
the focus, in case you didn't hear that prompting, the focus is on what we as Christians can do. All right?
Eat your heart out.
Don't be too hard on him because I'm expecting one when we come. We hope that our people in line.
Okay, well, we wanted to focus on tonight is at least what Chuck and I talked about. We didn't consult with you guys, you two, Jim and Dan, but is the question of what we as American citizens can do about apartheid in Southern Africa. Because I don't think there's much disagreement among us that it's terrible, that it's a heresy, it's against God's plan for the world, and that it's a terrible situation. But where disagreement comes in is what Americans' role is in responding to that situation, how we can help bring about peaceful change in Southern Africa. Those of you who know me know that one of my favorite movies is The Year of Living Dangerously, and I always remember the scene in that movie where Billy visits this terrible slum in Indonesia and is so horrified at the situation, then agonizes over that question from the Gospel of Luke, what then shall we do? And that's what we're going to agonize over tonight, is what then shall we do about Southern Africa? So I have three suggestions for you tonight. The first would be to pray for our sisters and brothers in Southern Africa. I think that's the first and most important. Whenever I travel to South Africa and Namibia and ask people, what can I do for you, what can we do for you, that's always the top of their list, is pray for us. Please ask your people to pray for us. Your prayers are so important to us. It's very hard to be a Christian in our country, Bishop Rupone told us. So we need your prayers. We covet your prayers, and I pass that along to you. I read a quote this afternoon from Bishop Tutu that I just want to read an excerpt from. Because you are faithful in prayer, someone in South Africa suddenly receives an excess of grace. Inexplicably, it appears. Perhaps he is in solitary confinement or being tortured. and is able to say, these are God's children who are doing this. How is that possible except that you have prayed him into that state of grace? So prayers really are important to our sisters and brothers in South Africa and Namibia. The second thing would be economic pressures and sanctions against South Africa on the part of the U.S. government. I really believe that that's an important step. It seems to be a real possibility this year for the first time in a long time, and I'll be advocating, I've also been sending mail up here over the last couple months, in favor of some legislation which has passed the House now with 5 sanctions against South Africa on the part of the U.S. government. It still needs to be voted on in the Senate. There's been an attempt to water down the bill, and so I invite those of you, especially from the states of Pennsylvania, Washington, or Minnesota, to write to your senators, to the moderate Republican senators, to encourage their support for this bill, which is S-635, the Anti-Apartheid Act of 1985, that calls for some very concrete, though mild, very mild compared to the trade embargo we've got against Nicaragua and other countries, for example, very mild, very specific, and yet important sanctions against South Africa. The third thing I just wanted to mention, although Chuck is going to focus on this, is economic pressures as individuals. And I guess one that I, the ALC statement on apartheid suggests some possibilities, refraining from buying Krugerrands and South African gold coins, and that's part of the legislation S-635. We're trying to get the sale of those banned in the United States. But one that you can do personally is, in the statement, encourage ALC members to refrain from purchase of South African imports, including gold and diamonds. It is possible to get engaged without a diamond ring. In fact, I'm looking for somebody's story to write about for an article we're trying to do. If you or someone you know has decided not to have a diamond ring because diamonds come from South Africa, I'd really like to talk to you because I think that's a really important witness. And then people can ask you, why don't you have a diamond? And you can tell them. Not that we need to judge people who do buy diamonds, but that that's sort of a personal choice that you can make that does have an impact, since most of the diamonds in the world, 90-some percent, I think it is, come from South Africa.
And then, you'd be willing to do that yourself, right? You get engaged without a diamond?
Well, I'm not engaged, but yeah, you're right. You'd be willing to get engaged without a diamond. Okay, so if anybody wants to talk to me about that,
couldn't resist.
Yeah, I know, okay. Well, I can't write that story, so. And then the fourth thing is something that we have to take seriously, and that is when I ask South Africans and Namibians, what can we do for you? One of the things that they put very high on the list is model in your society that it is possible for people of different races to live together peacefully and justly. They have no models to go by. They don't see that it really is possible for whites and blacks to live together side by side in a just kind of situation. And really look to us in the United States to see a sign of hope, to see models for how that can happen. And I guess I believe that we've got a long way to go in the United States to be that kind of model. Certainly we don't have apartheid in our Constitution, but there's a lot that we each can do in our own lives to help create a more just situation, to build understanding between the races in our country. And that is something important we can do to bring about a peaceful change in South Africa, both to give whites and blacks hope for peaceful change there, that races can live together. A couple weeks ago, I had lunch with Paul Bowe, who was very active with Native American concerns a few years ago. And he was telling about how in the northern Wisconsin district, which he's a resident of, Native Americans living within 10 miles of ALC congregations, and yet the hatred, it's a relationship of hatred rather than understanding and witness. And it's those kinds of things that we need to address as Americans, the hatred between races that still exists here, the intolerance, the misunderstandings, and I think that that is one way that we can help bring about change in Southern Africa.
This is very much like South Africa sitting in the midst of.
We're trying to model something here. Kind of a heartache going on here.
Black and white ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I agreed to say a few words about the divestment and disinvestment question, because that has been coming up this week, and I think for the most part we've said, wait till Wednesday evening, we'll get into it then. That's one of the possible responses that we can make. One kind of economic pressure, which has gotten a lot of attention in our society in these last months and years. I like to distinguish between the two terms, divestment and disinvestment. I'm losing that battle, I think. Barbara and I have talked about this and shared some writing on it. They seem to be used increasingly in an interchangeable way, but I think the two words still have somewhat different meaning. The way I've used the terms, divestment means to remove investments from companies so that the American Lutheran Church, which has a policy of divesting, divests when it sells its stocks in Control Data or 3M or Honeywell or whatever. That's divestment. Disinvestment has been used more for referring to the withdrawal of the companies from South Africa. Now that may be a distinction that in the language will not survive, but for the sake of tonight's discussion, I'd like to suggest that we use the two terms. Divestment means to sell your stocks in companies that are in Southern Africa. Disinvestment means when the companies themselves leave. They disinvest. They remove their foreign investment from the area. I'll speak for the ALC. I don't know the LCA or LCMS patterns as well. The LCA has a somewhat similar policy to the ALC's on divestment. The ALC has asked the companies over a period of 7 years now, the companies in which we have been investing, which are in Southern Africa, to do many things. We have asked them through shareholder resolutions at annual meetings. We've asked them through dialogue with corporate executives. We've asked them through letters to them. As an investor now, we've talked with them. And we've asked them to do many things, among them these three. Stop expanding in South Africa and Namibia. If you're going to stay there, at least commit yourself to a policy of no expansion. And that's usually defined in terms of share, market share. Don't expand your market share, and don't expand into other lines of products than the ones you're already there with. Secondly, stop selling strategic materials, strategic items to police and military. That's focused heavily on computer technology. But whatever are items of strategic nature for police and military to use in enforcing the apartheid system. Thirdly, we've asked that they not move into Namibia. If they aren't already there, don't go into Namibia until Namibia is independent. I have to tell you, we have not succeeded in gaining company acceptance on any of these requests. We've struck out totally. And I think that's the experience of the other churches too. Companies are very polite, they listen, but we haven't won on any of those requests. We have gained a few modest achievements with banks, through pressure on banks. And I think with banks it's somewhat different, because if you remove your deposits from banks, they immediately feel it. The ALC some years ago sold $2 million in short-term CDs, certificates of deposit, with Citibank. And Citibank immediately felt it, as big as they are. They knew it, and they were unhappy about it, and they continued to ask us to come back. Why did we do it? We did it because they would not agree to stop making loans to the South African government. Some banks have agreed to stop making loans to the South African government under the pressure of the threat of withdrawal, or we'll stop doing business with you. I think with banks it's somewhat different than with stock companies, because if you sell your stocks in a company, the immediate result of that is somebody else buys those shares on the market. So in the long term, there may be an impact, but in the short term, it's not the same as with removing bank deposits. Secondly, another modest achievement is some banks have agreed, under pressure from church depositors and others, to stop selling Kruger Rands in the United States. That has had some success. But all of the global pressure on South Africa has not brought about basic change in the apartheid system or in the status of Namibian independence thus far. That, it seems to me, is why there is pressure now for tougher measures, and why that is building. Because what we have done in dialogue with companies and other kinds of pressure have not accomplished very much.
And what are the dates you're talking about of the pressure beginning by the church?
In our case, it was 1978. I think the very earliest work by churches with companies as shareholders was about 1971 or 72. So it's not a very old movement, that kind of activity with the corporations in which churches had investments. So some of the things Barbara has referred to, including possible legislation passed by our Congress this year, I think is a result of frustration with these other efforts which haven't accomplished very much. In recent months, both Desmond Tutu, the Anglican bishop in South Africa, the Nobel Peace Prize winner last year, and Leon Sullivan, the American Baptist, Black Baptist minister who's responsible for the Sullivan Code of behavior for U.S. companies in South Africa. Both of them have said in the last few months, if there is no progress toward dismantling apartheid, not just reforming it, but doing away with it, in the next 18 to 24 months, both of them will join the call for withdrawal of foreign investment from South Africa. That's significant, because Sullivan, for the most part in the last decade, has not joined that call. Now he's saying, if there's no progress in the next 18 to 24 months, I will join it. And Tutu has said the same thing. Our divestment, it seems to me, can have two direct consequences, whether or not any other results occur. I am not personally persuaded that in the short run, the divestment by U.S. churches or other U.S. investors from companies that are there will get the companies to leave, nor am I persuaded that it will bring down the apartheid system by itself. I think it's one piece of a total strategy. I think it should be one piece of our total strategy, but it shouldn't be the only thing that the U.S. churches and U.S. Christians do. Whatever you feel about the results of divestment or even disinvestment, that is, the companies leaving, I think you can say, I can say, I would say, that it has two direct consequences which are immediate. And they are these. It will certainly eliminate our earning of a return. Our churches, our pension plan members, whoever. And most of the funds we're talking about with the church bodies are pension money. And that's an important point, because legally those are under a different kind of status than the church's own money would be. It is money held in trust by the churches for its pension plan members, likewise with labor union pension funds and so on. Divestment would accomplish immediately the elimination of our earning of a return, as a pension plan member of my church, earning a return through direct participation in the apartheid economy. I would be able to say, for whatever that's worth, I am not benefiting for my retirement income from the apartheid economy. That would clearly be the case. The other thing I think clearly would happen is it does make a strong public witness. It makes a strong public statement to the South African government, first of all, and they are very much aware of it and they don't like it, and that's why I think the divestment strategy is going to pursue, if for no other reason. The South African government is very unhappy about it, uneasy about it, and tries to talk out of it those who are advocating. Since 1980, when the ALC adopted a kind of modified divestment policy, the South African consulate in Chicago has been to see us at least once a year to try to persuade us that we're wrong, to get us to reverse it. So it would make a strong public witness. First of all, it does to the South African government. Secondly, it does to the companies in which we have been investing. Thirdly, to the oppressed people of South Africa and Namibia. Even if it doesn't accomplish anything in the short run for their freedom, it does say we are in solidarity. It's one way of saying we are in solidarity with you. And it says something to the world community about our abhorrence of apartheid. So I think you cannot claim that divestment does everything, doesn't do all that some of its advocates claim for it, but it does do some things. And I think it's an important symbolic part of the total strategy, and I do say we need a total strategy, not just divestment. Okay?
Before we get into questions and answers, I wanted Dan and Karin to just give a couple reflections or thoughts that they might have. Karin especially, because people will probably won't direct anything to her. She told me this afternoon she had an opinion. Do you want to say something, Karin?
No.
Okay. All right, Dan, you?
She was here. Yeah, there are some things I could share that are not related to divestment. So.
Okay, do we want to just jump right into that then and come back to some other reflections? I thought
we don't need to limit our discussion to divestment.
Yeah,
tonight.
We're so slanted that way. I thought, well, maybe we put something else on the floor and then.
Yeah, thought maybe just three real short sentences about what really shocked us the most. I mean, we more or less knew it before we went there, but it was, I think, so much more shocking being there than we had ever expected. And the first is just what apartheid does to families in South Africa. And, you know, I wanted to come back because we value family togetherness here in the United States. I know that and I feel that. It's very important to us. And just the heart-wrenching story after story after story of families that are separated, are torn apart by the apartheid system. To me, it is the most tragic part of apartheid, and much more than I ever expected. Secondly, we tended to think before we went that apartheid was mainly a division between white and black. And the amazement of how effective what I call a demonic system has been of dividing the oppressed against each other. Where you have Indian, colored, and then black, and not just the black, but all the different tribes, and how the apartheid system has worked to separate and divide tribal group against tribal group against tribal group, and has effectively worked a system to divide those people so they don't unite together. And that's another thing I was amazed at, just how effective this has been. The third thing, and I think it relates to the whole question of divestment, is that a lot of times when we here in the United States talk about divestment, and this is true also of President Reagan's constructive engagement.
Is that the right word? Constructive engagement.
Constructive engagement. We sit around and talk like we have 50 years. And the crisis of South Africa, and we could feel that and be that and see that and hear that when we were there, is the crisis is gaining such momentum that you just have a sense that if I went back there in a month, the momentum is faster, the crisis, and another month is faster, and what we saw was much more than a year before. We don't have 20 years to sit around and say, well, gradually American corporations can help improve this country. We were told that at one time, South African government would report the days when there was an uprising in one of the townships. While we were there, the government was celebrating because there was one day when there wasn't in all the townships of South Africa. Now it's daily, the uprisings in the townships. So it's a crisis situation. The government, we felt more and more, is pushed up against the wall from all sides. And Bishop Buthelezi, am I right? The name?
Buthelezi.
In Soweto said, it's one of the greatest signs of hope in South Africa today is the government is so out of control, they don't know what they're doing on this situation. You know, they're no longer in control. And one former political columnist, a white, told us the logjam has been broken on the apartheid system, and the government is just, there's movements that have been set off that the government is no longer in control. So that's the third thing. It's just the crisis there, I think, is beyond what we think when we sit around and talk about this, you know, divestment, this or divestment that. Okay.
And then...
Yeah, it seems to me that we're all in the same boat, and the boat is named frustration. It seems to me that we all have a sense that this is a very evil and demonic thing. To have written into the laws of the land slavery. And in essence, that's what it is. But how in the world do you bring pressure to bear for a country to change its laws? Now, it seems to us that economic pressure is one form of pressure that governments seem to listen to. But it's almost grasping at straws. I'm not so sure that even divestment is going to have all that much impact. Governments are very diversified in their trade. It's not simply gold and diamonds. They're agricultural products. They're all kinds of things. I think it's very difficult. And it almost becomes a mark of frustration. What do? You sense that there's something that's really bad going on here. In fact, something that we believe is against the will of God. But what in the world can you do? What can you do as a government? It could be that certain pressures could be brought to bear. What can you do as individual citizens? Again, I think frustration. I don't think there are snappy answers. If anybody has any answers, I think that's what we're going to be talking about tonight.
Yeah, I was to say now, after you each had a vote, are there any amongst the panel where you'd like to respond to each other, just briefly?
Well, I have a quick response to Jim's last comment, and I think it's part of the frustration for us, but we are used to having power in the world, we of the United States, and I think we're used to feeling that if we want something to change, we can bring pressure to change it. The fact is that we probably are not, we in the United States, or Western Europe, or Canada, or anywhere else in the world, outside of Southern Africa. We are not going to be the prime actors in bringing down the apartheid system. We can be supportive, we can be helpful, we can be in solidarity with, we can pray with, all of that, but we are not the primary actors. I think it's going to be done from within. It's going to be brought about from within, with or without violence. And we're going to have to get used to the feeling of being, to some extent, on the sidelines, cheering, supporting, doing what we can, but not being the primary actors. And that's hard for Americans to get used to, I think.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to respond to what you said too, Jim. I agree that divestment is limited, but it seems to me the strongest argument in favor of it is that the South African government is so paranoid about it. They spend millions of dollars in the United States on PR, or whatever you want to call it, to try to dissuade us from divesting. If it's not going to make that much of an impact, why are they so busy trying to prevent it? And then, second of all, I was going to say, I think increasingly, at least, I think I referred to you, Chuck, an article from the Wall Street Journal from this fall that South Africa is becoming a worse and worse investment climate. This was from, I forget who, but a corporate executive saying, if we weren't already in South Africa, we sure wouldn't go in.
Yeah.
Because the return on our investment is being reduced, the political instability makes it a very risky place to be invested. Many American corporations have pulled out. Polaroid, Pan Am, now you can say what you want about Pan Am, maybe that was for other reasons, but there is a sense that the investment climate is not nearly as good there as it used to be, and that in fact companies that aren't in there already are not going in. And so I think that kind of thing indirectly places pressure on the South African government for change, and we have to be hoping for peaceful change, not just for cosmetic reforms like saying now that you can have sex with a member of another race or whatever, but for some significant reforms, and that we need to put pressure on the government to be thinking seriously about reforms. And one way is to get American companies to start putting that pressure on themselves, either for change or that they'll be leaving. And so I think that indirectly, in about a three-step process, there's something.
But it becomes a matter of frustration. I don't care how you slice the pie.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, one response to Chuck is that one thing we notice is how sensitive South African government and the white people of South Africa are to American opinion.
That's true.
Every night on the news, like it seemed like half of the news was about the United States and what the United States is now doing in relation to South Africa. It was seemed sometimes to be the majority of the news when we were there, and they love to find ways we are racist, and it always makes the front page of the newspaper. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very sensitive about what you think.
Okay. Why is showing favoritism?
David, would you like to? I have just two information questions. Do you know what the specific censures are in that S635? And then a second question was, you had mentioned, Chuck, that there were some banks that had agreed to stop making loans to South Africa. Do you know what those banks are? And are they?
I don't have the list complete in my head. The last big one that I remember was Continental Illinois. But they did agree under pressure, and Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago was part of the group pressuring them. That's to stop selling Krugerrands. On bank loans, quite a few banks have agreed not to make loans to the South African government under pressure from depositors.
On S-635, I get my information from Martin Selvick at the Lutheran Council of the USA in Washington. You might want to start writing to him for updates, too. They publish a very good newsletter called Focus that keeps you up to date on new stuff. The specific sanctions that passed in the House are, let's see, ban of bank loans to the South African government and government-owned entities, prohibits the sale of computers, including spare parts and service, to the South African government, prohibits importing Krugerrands into the United States, and prohibits new investment by U.S. corporations in South Africa. So there, too, it's not asking the corporations to disinvest, but rather asking them not to expand. The bans on Krugerrand imports and new investment, though, would be waived if the 2-2 conditions are starting to be met within, I think it's 12 months here, which are conditions like allowing families to live together, allowing everyone to seek employment anywhere in South Africa, elimination of homelands, an end to removals, elimination of residence restrictions, and beginning of negotiations.
Barbara, why don't you say something about homelands with the map, since it's up here? Just say a word about the map.
Okay, well, this, all right, 1 minute, girls. This map shows South Africa, and you can see the yellow area is white-owned South Africa. The homelands are those colored blobs on there, and the red arrows indicate removals. I'd say the worst problem right now in South Africa is the resettlement or removals of black people into these terribly overcrowded homelands. And so that is a, and then as Dan said, they're all divided out by ethnic groups. Sotho's and Tswana's might have gotten along together great for centuries, but now suddenly they're being divided and new divisions are being created. So that's the homeland problem.
It's very similar to our reservations when we had the
On S-635, there has been a more conservative substitute attempted, which is a Lugar and Mathias bill. Charles Mathias, and what's Lugar's first name? I don't know. Anyway.
From Indiana.
Yeah, an attempted substitution, which allegedly is a sanctions bill, but actually it isn't really, in the opinion of most people. So don't accept that from your senator. Write to them and tell them specifically to oppose, in my opinion, first, you don't have to agree with me, but I would write to them and say, oppose the Lugar-Mathias substitute, support S-635 with all the conditions, and if you want a list of those, I can give them to you in writing.
James? Two questions. I hear apartheid and apartheid. Are they equally correct?
I understand that apartheid is the pronunciation in Afrikaans, and apartheid is the way English-speaking people usually say it. But I kind of like to say apartheid because it emphasizes the hate, I guess. That's a sneaky thing to do.
Barbara, you were thinking that. Do you have another opinion on that?
No, no, it's the same word. I say apartheid now because, I don't know.
Been there.
But actually, the South Africans will claim we don't use that word anymore when the
South African government.
Yeah, the government will say we call it separate development now. So if you want to be in with the government, you don't use apartheid at all. You use separate development. But
it simply means apartness in Afrikaans. That's
you
what the word means.
Way, yeah.
Apartness.
We heard the announcement when we were there by the government that apartheid was over.
Oh, really?
They're still doing separate development.
I had a real question. That was
good. Oh, okay, sorry. Go ahead.
What is the side of the Afrikaans government? Are they afraid if they loosen at all, they're going to be another Rhodesia? Is that the problem? What is the basic reason for defying world opinion and continuing with this program?
Who wants to take that? Briefly.
Since I haven't been there, why don't I answer? Well, I think it's a classic example of a group of white people from Europe who came in and developed a country, came in with money and with power, and they're very fearful of losing what is theirs. And we're talking about generations of people who've been there. They regard this as their country. And they're running very scared. They're in the minority. They have the power. They have the weight of law behind them. But they are very fearful of losing. And yet, there was a CBS special on Zimbabwe, and the interview was with blacks and whites. And the same thing happened to old Rhodesia. same thing happened there, but strangely enough, the blacks who are now ruling Zimbabwe knew very well that they couldn't run the country without the assistance of that white community. The country club is now integrated for the first time. They speak to one another on the street. They're friends. There was not a blood reprisal. There were not people thrown in the clink. Now, if that's any kind of a clue as to what might happen in South Africa, I think Dan was the one who alluded to the hands on the clock are moving very fast, and I'm not sure there's a lot of time before some things might happen which none of us would like to see happen.
Then you go beyond the point of, I mean, total frustration beyond the point of the Rhodesian solution.
Could I ask a question related to that?
Okay.
I'm sorry. I don't know your
name. Is that all right with you?
Sure.
But let's get opinions as well as questions, okay?
Sure.
I don't want to hear people's opinions.
Jan, I'm sorry. I was thinking Carol and Barbara. There's another element, I think, to that that maybe someone would speak to, and that is the sort of religiosity that white South Africans connect with themselves in relation to black people. Does anyone want to address that?
Yeah, I think that's an important point.
It is important.
For many white South Africans, it is the will of God that the races be kept separate, even if there is no advantage for one over the other, which, you know, many would say that's not the intention, to have one superior to another, but to keep them separate is the will of God, because God does not want racial mixing. There is a theological, religious basis for many white South Africans in that view, I'm sure. But I also believe it always gets intermixed with their feeling of maintaining comfort. It is, many have said it's the most comfortable existence in the world if you're a white South African. The standard of living is the highest of any people in the world if you're white in South Africa.
I want to express certain opinion, but also to have Chuck in particular respond to the statement. On that idea of the frustration that we experience in thinking about this idea of change, when we graduated from seminary this fall at Lutheran Northwestern, that all of the D's came to us, the divisions, to tell us about what they do. And some of the people that came were from the Board of Pensions and I think the Board of Trustees.
Yes.
And we asked some questions about investment. And this was a day when you weren't there. But
was I there later or
you were there another day? We had
another day.
A couple different Wednesdays.
You should have us come the same day.
Yeah, I wanted to be, that's why I'm interested. When this topic came up, it was immediately from a very wonderful presentation. What the division does, there was a great deal of tension, and the response to the questions made on how the ALC invests were, we are aware that wherever you invest in companies, you have problems. And we got environment, and we have race, and we have all these issues that someone's upset about. We're doing the best we can, and the response was that I feel good that I'm a Lutheran when I know that everywhere I'm going to send my money, there's going to be some problems, and we just have to go and do. And that sort of theological interpretation to me was very inadequate, that in a sense, we don't want to be extremely uncomfortable with the situation in South Africa and push to do whatever we can to stop our participation. And I just felt that I wondered if the ALC itself isn't frustrated in the head office.
Well, I think so. For a couple of reasons. First of all, I would say as a Lutheran ethicist, or an ethicist who tries to look at things Lutheranly, I believe there is no such thing as a pure place to put my money. My money, your money, anybody's money, because I think there's no such thing as a pure, totally pure act. But given that, I still think there are relatively better and worser places to invest. For instance, the ALC, the LCA, the LCMS, I think it's true of LCMS, I'm not sure of that. Most religious bodies in the United States have never invested in liquor and tobacco stocks. Somebody once told me that LCMS had invested in Bush, Anheuser-Busch. It wasn't a moral problem. It's not a moral problem for me to invest in Anheuser-Busch, but it has been for some of my predecessors in the church body I belong to. So the ALC has never invested in liquor or tobacco stocks. That's making a moral judgment, a priori. Pension money or anything else, we've never invested there. And it's for reasons of ethics or morality. So I think there are relatively better places and relatively worse places to invest. I personally would like to see us not invest in nuclear weapons manufacturing.
We still do, to a degree. I mean, we're not in that in a big way, but we're in some companies that incidentally do some of that. Because a lot of companies do a little bit of defense contracting. Having said that, I want to say something of a kind of a defense nature for the problem the Board of Trustees has. The problem faced by the Board of Trustees of our church, my church, the ALC, is, and this is true of all the church bodies for the most part, the money they're handling is basically pension money. It is not the church's own money. It is the money the church is holding in trust as a steward for the church's retirees and future retirees, some of whom are in this room. I happen to be one of those. I can say I don't care whether my return for retirement earns the best possible return. In fact, I don't. I would take a somewhat lower return if you wouldn't invest in such and so. But there are fellow members of the pension plan of my church who don't agree with that. And there is the possibility that some of them would bring suit against the Board of Trustees if they did not try, as the law requires, to get the highest return. So what their policy is, and this is the kind of fence-riding position that many feel is equivocating, their policy is to withdraw from companies that are in South Africa when, in their judgment, there is an equivalent return somewhere else in a company that's not in South Africa. And on that basis, they have drawn down from 27 companies in 1980 to 8 at present, 8 companies that are in South Africa. They're not pure, we're not pure, but they're out of 20 or 19 of the 27. They've drawn down in percentage of stocks from 32 to about 10 or 8 or 9, something like that.
It seems to me that what Barb was saying earlier about it being a shaky financial market and so on, that is in a sense, there's going to be a lot of opportunity to go somewhere else and have
higher. Yeah, but see, that's an issue for the companies that are considering their investment in South Africa. Most of the U.S. companies that are there earn less than 1% of their return from their operations in South Africa. So that could be in real trouble, and they could still be good stocks. I hope that's a somewhat adequate response.
Have you lost any money?
Not to my knowledge. I don't know how you prove that kind of thing anyway. It's very hard to prove, and there's never been a court test of this issue anyway. If it did go to court, I don't know how either side would prove that if you'd stayed in those companies, you would have earned more than you got by going in these companies.
This is more information rather than opinion, but for those of us that are halfway around the world, when you bring this up, the kinds of defenses that are usually brought up are that, well, there is legislation, the Sullivan Act, whatever it is, and we only do business in accordance with that. And I'd like to hear somebody explain what that means when they say that. And the other is this thing that Dan was talking about when he said that apartheid is over. What do they mean? What are they doing that they try to use that as an argument that there is some change?
Dan, you want to start?
Yeah, the second, this, I think I can be safe in saying that governments are wonderful at semantics. To name old things new names that sound better. You know, so like say they would talk more about separate development, which is really apartheid. So that.
But there, I think.
All right, I'll speak about the Sullivan Code. They just named it a new word, separate development is all. It's the same. I mean, some of the petty apartheid things are being dismantled. You now can marry somebody of a different racial group, but the problem is you wouldn't have anywhere to live in South Africa. You have to live apart from each other.
Or your house crossed the line.
Yeah, something like that. The Sullivan Code is excellent, and about half the American companies have signed it. But I would just say, though, I don't think it goes far enough. The American companies that we did with 3M is where we spent the longest time because, you know, it's a Minnesota-based company and stuff, and they gave us a lot of free film and tape and things. They have an excellent system of integration at the workplace. Many top-level managers are blacks, but there's only so much you can do at the workplace. The black managers have to go home to Soweto. The white managers go home to Johannesburg. The whites can live with their families. The black managers can't live with their families. And it's all that. I mean, a workplace is only 8 hours a day. There's the rest of your life. The blacks have to carry passes. The whites don't. Plus, I guess I would say that, well, American companies employ less than 1% of the workforce. So there's, 3M does great with its 300 employees. But what's 300 employees? I mean, that it's some, yes, but it's few. And so I don't think that advantages of the Sullivan principles, in my opinion, outweigh the disadvantage of American presence, corporate presence in South Africa, and the possibility that that means that our administration, that's, I mean, we defend the system now because there's so much American money invested in it, and I really fear that we would go in on the wrong side if compelled to do so.
That is why it's significant that Leon Sullivan has recently said, if there is no progress in the next 2 years for dismantling apartheid, I will join the chorus of those calling for withdrawal.
Because
up to now he has said, the answer is workplace reforms, U.S. companies setting the best example. That's the way to bring about change. He's saying, I'll give it 2 more years.
We had one, her name was Helen Zella, who was a former political correspondent for a newspaper that the government ran on the business, ran daily news. She called strongly for what she calls selective investment. You know, choose one or two companies in South Africa that are doing everything right, you know, and then put all your investments with them. I mean, she had a very strong argument for that, and my feeling some way, even to her, is to come back with the question, is there time to do anything that the most drastic little thing? I mean, it's always going to be a little thing that we're going to do.
You know, that's what the Investor Responsibility Research
Center,
IRRC, whatever it is, yeah, in Washington is called for, too. Don't try to get every American company to leave, but rather focus on a few, the few worst. And there are some that are good. I mean, there really is, in a sense, no reason to get 3M to leave right away. All they do is make tape for people to stick their papers together in South Africa, and they sell it in South Africa.
No strategic materials.
But I mean, there is, computer sales are in a different category. The computer companies are strategically more, much more important. I'd say the oil companies too. South Africa has no oil production of its own. It's very dependent on Exxon and Mobil to stay alive. Therefore, those would be the companies to encourage to leave. And selective investment, yeah, maybe 3M should get more investment. People will always need to.
I recognize the evilness of apartheid, and I understand the solidarity expressed with Black brothers and sisters, but I think my concern or struggle is with who actually, as a nation, do we identify with in looking at our own history with the Native American Indian, and understanding what's happening with the white ruling class there in terms of the fear when I think about what has, and it's still happening with the Native American Indian. I don't know if there's any way to, it's like hard to point the finger when in a sense I can point it at my own country, and yet wanting that to change there, but how can it also be a similar effort in our own country and the church taking a stand with
nothing? So you want them to give some suggestions how we in our own lives?
Well, I feel like it's so easy to, we're so distant from that country, yeah, and so it's easy to point the finger, you know, they're bad people, but...
How can we deal with racism at home, is your question. How can we relate it to our racism at home?
And white South Africans always bring that up. They'll say, what about, and I heard that also from Palestinians in Israel too, interestingly enough. I mean, this is no different from the situation in your country where you drove out the Native Americans and conquered them and now have conquered the land, and that's what we've done too. Why is it right in your country and wrong in ours? And what we as Americans have to say is, it wasn't right in our country. What we did was wrong too, but that doesn't, you know, and so admit the fault and then say, and it's wrong also when you're doing it. And, you know, yeah, we can't justify our own history any more than they can justify theirs. It's as wrong.
Also, I think while we have to recognize all of that in our history and continue to work on racism in our own society, we have to recognize at the same time that there are differences. We still have a lot of racism in the United States. We do not have enshrined in our Constitution the denial of citizenship rights to any group because of their race. That's a difference. We also do not have theological support, religious support, churches that officially support the policy of racial separation in the United States. South Africa does. And I think that's why it's a particular call to the global Christian community to address it. Because it is in a way, it's a perversion of the biblical witness that is being used to support apartheid.
I guess if I was a Native American Indian,
yeah,
you know, looking at this issue, I would feel kind of cheated. you know, where is the church for me? And I feel like there needs to be more said, maybe in the church, about the issues.
About racism at home. Yeah, I agree with you.
Okay, you have one, two, and three.
Don't talk to us. I mean, everybody.
Yeah, you
can talk to each other.
But I think we'll really have one time for this. One, two, three. Go ahead.
I'd like to make just some general observations, not so much posing a question to the panel. I don't know whether I had an opportunity or a negative experience, but I represented a South African client back in the early 60s. I felt at that time it was a great experience. There were no groups that met like this at the time and talked about a thing called apartheid. It wasn't even a word that anybody knew about. And the gentleman that I dealt with was a Lutheran. And he still lives in Namibia. Time magazine about 20 years ago called him the wealthiest individual in the world. And he came to Seattle because his family ties are there looking for venture capital. Because of some of the preliminary governmental unwritten sanctions, he was not able to get that capital. The reason he wanted to come to the United States to secure that capital was because the Chinese communists were making offers as fast as he could turn them down to finance him in Namibia. Now, during the course of this exposure to this gentleman, we had several things that occurred in presenting information to the World Court to attempt to get the mandate status of Southwest Africa removed. We had labor laws that were passed in Southwest, in Union of South Africa, which were 100% enforceable under the mandate status of Southwest Africa on the Southwest Africa people, and he was that person.
That's the older name for Namibia, Southwest Africa.
Correct. Now, the summation of all this, and I have not had contact with this person now for many, many years, but the summation of all this, when all this discussion started by apartheid, about apartheid, which is a horrible thing, as a matter of fact, racial discrimination in this country is a horrible thing. We don't really know what it is until you have moved down south and lived amongst it, as my wife and I did back in the 50s. We tend to think in terms that we're lily white sometimes in these areas, and that we can just sociologically or politically make some decisions in this country that will have overwhelming effect on other people. Well, I think I can say to you that the things that you will attempt to do socially, politically, and economically will, for the most part, if not entirely, fail as you present them to the South African regime. I think Charlie made a comment, and I agree with it wholeheartedly. The change that is going to have to come is going to have to come from within. Admittedly, we can support that. I'm not saying that at all, but I think we have to recognize reality for what it is. Now, part of the little kicker that bothers me about the thing of disinvestment or divestiture, whatever you wish to call it, and laws that restrict venture investment is that I can absolutely guarantee you what I know from the inside of what's going on in Namibia, which is a very critical country in this discussion of apartheid, that if we drive away potential venture capitalization within Namibia, you are absolutely inviting the Chinese communists. Now, their position is that they will enter that investment market. They will bring their own people from China. They will operate their own operation, and they will not at all be interested in employing in any way, shape, or form the native people of that country.
Did you want to say something, Chuck?
No, I'd like to give some other people a chance to get in.
I just wanted to respond to the comment about the Native American situation in America. I don't have any representative word from the Native American community, but Ramona Bennett, who is a name that some of you may recognize, is a very activist Puyallup Indian in the Northwest and has been involved a lot in Native American rights in the Seattle, Greater Seattle area, and I were arrested together at the South African consulate this spring and with several other people. And she, in her speech before that arrest, very much identified with the people of South Africa and the struggle that they're going through, and understood the homelands to be analogous to the reservations, and really felt very strongly that America needed to not let this happen.
I'm more familiar with Zimbabwe than I am with South Africa and Namibia, and I know with the problems that still exist that up to 40% of the whites left, and they are now coming back. They were afraid. They see that even with its problems, it's going to be okay. They're going to solve them. So I know that it has worked in another country. But it looks to me like there's a lot more problems here with all this resettlement, with families separated, all the things you've been pointing out. And Christians and wise people are pushing to get rid of apartheid. What I'm worried about is when apartheid goes, which it will, are some wise heads looking ahead to the next step so that our black brothers and sisters aren't going to be in a worse mess than they are now? How are they going to be helped, and how is that country going to be helped? Is anybody looking ahead to when it happens?
I don't know about South Africa. I'll leave that to somebody else to comment on. I will say from Namibia, more has been done by the international community to prepare the Namibian people for independence and self-government, partly because of this long wait. The UN has created the Institute for Namibia and the Council for Namibia, and they have been training future civil servants in Namibia for 15 years at a center in Lusaka, and some little part of your tax dollars and mine go to support that. That has never happened before in the history of decolonization.
So that is planning.
For Namibia, I would say there has been a lot of preparatory work done. For South Africa, I don't know.
Yeah, if I could just respond, there's much fear in people, and I mean black people in South Africa that we talk to realize that the problems in South Africa would not be solved when they get the vote. You know, because apartheid has divided people against each other over the years, and all we can say is, number one, that never can be an excuse to say we must keep white power, and that often in the world is used as an excuse. Secondly, it calls on us again to pray for and support the forces among the black people, colored people, Indian, so-called colored, we like to say Indian people in South Africa, to pray for and support those forces of unity, and especially to pray for the churches, because it's the churches that are, I think, the black churches out there that are working the hardest for the type of reconciliation today that would carry over into a new South Africa. But there's both forces, and the future is risky, and it's fear about that kind of a future and realization that will not be easy. But what other choice?
I just want us to be ready to lead in to help the support as much as we're leaping to get rid of what we see as
and there's people. Wonderful whatever forces of reconciliation, and will we, the rest of the world, support those and pray for them?
Chuck,
yes.
Chuck has got some things you
are. Yeah, I brought literature in that I don't want to haul back out. Everybody has to carry out what we bring into the village, but I don't want to carry it all out. So if you'll help me, if you're interested, help yourself to materials that are from the ALC position on apartheid and the recent action of the Church Council that supplements that, and then a summary of the comments that I opened with I have here if you're interested in that. I apologize for the fact that it's only ALC, but that's all the material I have access to.